Thank you very much, Jonathan. This is a pleasure to be here, and I really apologize for not being able to join you earlier on. It turns out that teaching schedule is such that I absolutely had to teach this year on Mondays and Wednesdays. So again, standard apologies. I suspect that I'm not the only person who did this. So I'm going to tell you about the the results of Fermi Observatory. By the way, is this the laser pointer? And that's the way it works. Perfect. The Fermi Observatory results from extragalactic sources, and in particular, we'll focus on active galactic nuclei that have jets. Again, we've heard a lot in this venue about the acceleration of particles, and I think that jets are a perfect example where that kind of observational data exists and are really quite compelling to try to understand how the process happens. I'm assuming that there hasn't been really much discussed about Fermi, so just very briefly, I will tell you how the main detector on board Fermi Observatory works. It is basically a particle tracker. And that's one of the reasons why the instrument had very heavy SLAC involvement, Stanford Linear Accelerator Center involvement in the construction, where the gamma ray interacts with foil, with high Z material that is in the detector, and it produces pairs which are then tracked with silicon strip detectors. That's pretty standard technique that has been used in many different particle colliders. The important part is that the instrument is not a telescope as such, even though it's called a telescope. Telescopes, you think about providing you a postage stamp size image of the sky. This instead provides two steradian field of view. So it means that the sky is being monitored really quite extensively and quite thoroughly. And of course, the instrument always points away from the Earth. So as the spacecraft orbits the Earth, the instrument looks at the sky, and then it moves rocks back and forth on alternative orbits to provide a complete view. The energy range is 30 MeV to 300 GeV. That's the nominal range of sensitivity of the instrument. But because of the fact that lower energy gamma rays provide bigger spread of the electron-positron pair, therefore it's harder to determine the direction of arrival of that photon, we currently work with 100 or 200 MeV lower energy threshold, simply because of the fact that it's much easier to localize the incoming gamma rays. The effective area is 12,000 square centimeters, and this is about a factor of 8 or so better than the predecessor of Fermi. The LAT is, you can think of it as a transistor, as a solid state device, whereas EGRET was a vacuum tube, basically, it was essentially a big chamber. This is the picture of the detector as it was installed in the shroud of the launcher, and a successful launch a little bit more than a year ago. And the data are indeed spectacular. This is the view of the galaxy in galactic coordinates, and you can see a number of different sources, and this is one object. There is a dark arrow near it. This is going to be the dark object that I'm going to be, the dark horse I'm going to be covering at the very end of my talk. This is a slide which is very, very wordy, but this is for you, since not much of this stuff has not been written yet, for you to be able to look at if you ever want to go back and take a look on the presentation that will be online. But as expected, as we know from the days of EGRET, GLAST is detecting, or Fermi is detecting, many active galaxies with jets. They're known as blazars. That's an observation classification. We are quite confident that that's very much their nature. It's at the moment we have one paper where we published first 3-month results with about 100 sources, but many more of those are appearing. And in fact, the identification, it's a very strong and important effort of Roger Romani and his group at Stanford. And Roger will be here telling you about pulsars later on today. That's his other hat that he's wearing. The number of those objects have been measured early in Fermi operations. And you might have seen some papers because they're already out or in press. And I will be talking a little bit about this telephone number, 3C454.3. Again, as I mentioned, we have the very first list of those objects in press. And as expected, they are strong emitters of gamma rays, but also in many cases, they're known for TeV radiation. So how do we approach the understanding of the sources? It's a bit like peeling an onion. We really study the Brodmann spectrum and variability. We try to understand the radiation processes, and that allows us to try to make some inferences on the energization of particles or acceleration of particles, the kind of stuff that much of it was discussed here. And then, of course, the goal is to find out what's the ultimate energy source and the connection of the accelerated particles to the accreting black hole. And again, the best picture that we have is a relativistic jet pointing close to our line of sight. And it's again powered by the accretion on the black hole that is upward of maybe 10 or 100 million solar masses. So 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9 even solar mass black holes really are in the centers of these objects. So let's get to the first results. The object 3C454.3 has been of great interest to observers simply because it flared up and became very active in the sky. Many of those active galaxies with jets, when they become bright, they also become very, very variable. The variability in various bands can reach factor of several, and in fact, in this particular case, you can see that it went the gamma ray flux during one of the early pointings, during the early observations with the LAT, has increased by factor of 6. So clearly, that kind of rapid increase implies relatively compact emission region, and one can actually use the standard arguments of pair production, in other words, opacity of gamma rays against X-rays for pair production to produce electron positrons, provides another constraint on how much relativistic boost the jet has to have. And here the boost is greater than 6, which is entirely consistent with the geometry inferred from the very long baseline observations where they infer, the VLBI observers infer that the Lorentz factor is 25. This is, of course, only a limit. Object can be less or more relativistically boosted. All it means is that it's not entirely just on the border of being optically thick to pair production. Again, the broadband observations plotted here are well described by the standard synchrotron and Compton models. I wouldn't be surprised if those were also discussed in the context of gamma ray bursts here. So just briefly, is the spectra have the broadband spectra ranging from radio to gamma ray band have this general behavior of two broad, very, very broad peaks, where the low energy peak is believed to be produced by synchrotron radiation, the high energy peak is Compton emission, presumably the same electrons that produce the synchrotron radiation, but with seed photons that have been dependent on the particular class of the objects. And an interesting result here, something that, it, again, is a challenge, a little bit of a challenge to theorists, is the fact that our broadband emission is not described as a power law, which is what you would expect in over a narrow range of spectral band. But instead, there's a relatively sharp break that we see in this particular object, and I wouldn't show it, of course, if it wasn't the case for many other targets, for many other sources, that there is a clear steepening of the spectrum. And that happens in this particular stock, in this particular source at about 2 GeV. The break is pretty steep between 2.3 in photon index to 3.5. So this cannot be easily described as just basically a cooling break associated with the with the particles cooling beyond the break more efficiently. So the best description again of the overall emission is the synchrotron Compton models, and we try to investigate what the cooling break can be due to. Of course, the very attractive proposition would be that we actually have a seed or pool of X-ray photons, which happen to be near the threshold against the 2 GeV gamma ray photons for pair production in the vicinity of the accretion disk itself. It turns out that we tried very hard to come up with this kind of nice and compelling scenario, and it turns out that the total internal emission from the accretion disk or the accretion disk corona in this source is simply not strong enough. So we concluded that very likely the break in the particle energy distribution under this scenario of synchrotron and Compton emission really must be intrinsic. So in this particular source, we inferred that the break is at the Lorentz factors of on the order of a few thousand. Again, this is still working in the context of the synchrotron models with electrons and Compton models of inverse Compton of the same electrons radiating against an ambient field. In this particular case, the ambient field, this is a picture from Shikora, Begelman, and Rees from a number of years ago, still very valid, very compelling picture or scenario for producing of radiation in active galaxies where the jet produces synchrotron radiation and either the intrinsic photons in the jet or the photons that are produced by the accretion disk and scattered back into jet produce the or provide the seed photons for the inverse Compton. So in this particular case, we believe that the external radiation, mainly radiation from broad emission line clouds or maybe broad emission line radiation rescattered by the medium that is the intercloud medium, is providing the seed photons. I will argue for another case, for a case of another object later on in my talk, that the radiation region is something that the distance of the emission from the central black hole is something that can be actually constrained on the data, and that provides another yet handle on where the inverse Compton radiation might actually be taking place and what is the source of the emission. This is just very briefly, I want to flash another example of another object where we actually have probably the highest delta lambda, delta luminosity divided by delta time detected in the GEV band so far. This is the very rapid increase by factor of several in the course of 12 hours. And here the constraints on the Doppler factor are actually quite a bit stronger, quite a bit more constraining, and they're quite comparable, in fact, to the ones that you observe from VLBI. So in this particular case, the source is probably just moderately optically thick, probably with the optical depth of on the order of 10th or so to the X-ray gamma ray pair production in a jet. But this is considering the fact that I have a fair amount of material. Let me just skip that and move on to a result that is a little bit more global now. And this is something, again, that is going to be a challenge to people who are working on the particle acceleration models and on the intrinsic conditions in relativistic jets and presumably relativistic shocks as the means to accelerate the particles. So in this particular case, I want to highlight the fact that even though many of the objects that we're observing have those very bright, rapid flares that last on a timescale of on the order of days, maybe weeks, the rise timescale can be very fast, the behavior in the spectral band, in other words, the spectral index, the description of the spectrum, is somewhat invariant with the intensity level. Notice that here, the object increased by about a factor of 5, and the spectral behavior, the spectral index of the source, remained relatively constant. That is actually not completely clear what is the reason for that, what is the origin for that. You could not possibly have an instantaneous injection of particles and then gradual cooling of those particles simply because you would see a spectral change associated with that. So there, our first knee-jerk reaction is that the flares must be probably distributed relatively, must be originated in regions that are distributed relatively uniformly through the jet. And the acceleration process must be continually going on. So the particle escape from the source is maybe more than anything else responsible for the drop in intensity. But so this is a challenge, again, to those of you who are thinking about particle acceleration. And this little inset here is only to show that we see a similar break. This spectrum is actually not consistent with being a simple power law. It's that the description here, nu f nu formal, form shows that we actually have some kind of a break going on around 1 GeV. So this is very similar behavior to what we've seen in the 454.3, the object I showed earlier. What I wanted to point out here is that 3C279 is one of those sources that has been studied. That's in fact the first, the flagship object in the Fermi catalog, in the EGRET catalog. That's the one that has actually put active galactic nuclei with jets on the map of GeV emitters. The other aspect that I wanted to highlight here that has to do with classes of objects is the fact that we see a bit of a spectral diversity of spectra in those jet-dominated active galaxies. In some cases, we see clear spectral breaks, and the spectra are being relatively soft, and this is, in a sense, a classification of those objects comes from optical and X-ray bands, but now gamma ray bands seem to mirror that. That relatively low luminosity sources seem to have their spectra increasing with frequency, and in fact, those are the sources where there is a relatively strong bright TeV emission. This is, those of you who follow the literature of active galactic nuclei with jets, this is the kind of objects that were normally described as Markarian 421-like, or high-energy peaked BLAC objects. That's where this HBL comes from. I understand that there is a lot of jargon and a lot of terminology, maybe almost botany here, but we still are at a stage where we're trying to classify those objects and really try to figure out what's going on with them. But this is an example of trying to combine the Fermi data with the ground-based gamma ray observatory data with Whipple and MAGIC. And of course, this source is relatively faint in the GeV gamma ray band, so we need to have number of days to integrate, whereas it varies very rapidly in the TeV band. So are those spectra plotted in this form meaningful? Well, we understand that there is an important need to have even better statistics than we have, but for the time being, that's all we have. But the fact that the variability is at such a large amplitude clearly indicates that the need for simultaneous observations is really clear. So just to show you the different kinds of spectral behavior between different classes of those jet-dominated active galactic nuclei, I wanted to highlight that the objects where we have strong, massive accretion disks with lots of luminosity, lots of photons, seem to have the peaks of their gamma ray emission, of their presumably produced by the inverse Compton, at lower energies than the objects where there is less of a strong radiation coming from this very highly luminous, very luminous accretion disk. So this is a very, very wordy slide that I will leave for you to read maybe later on if you want to look at it. But basically, there's two different classes of blazars. One of them is the flat spectrum radio quasars. Those are the objects which have massive accretion disks with very high accretion rate, in Eddington units. The other kind, the ones that are here on the bottom with a harder photon index, with one that rises into the TeV band, are the ones that presumably have much lower accretion rate. And it turns out that the distinction between two different classes initially was assumed to be maybe because of the fact that the quasars, the luminous quasars, have much higher mass black holes. Is now proven to be false. Those are objects where the black holes are probably comparably massive to the objects here. The difference is really pretty much the accretion rate. So just to satisfy your curiosity about what's going on with clusters of galaxies, I know that we're going to hear about it a little bit more tomorrow, but I wanted to give you a little bit of a preview that clusters of galaxies as such have not been detected by Fermi yet. We're now working on a paper putting together limits for those objects. But we have detected, at least in one case, in the case of Perseus cluster, strong AGN sitting in the middle of the cluster, and that's presumably, that's NGC 1275. It's a very well-known radio source, was initially classified as a Seyfert galaxy, but presumably this particular source is inflating the interior region in the cluster and is providing the power to inflate the cavities, and presumably also providing enough energy to prevent the material from the outer regions of the cluster to flow into the center and cool very rapidly. So we are now seeing at least one case, and presumably, hopefully, we'll be seeing more of those, where now having the gamma ray data for this source, which of course has been known for a long time to be an active galactic nucleus with a jet, now we can very clearly determine the total energetics, the total power that is being deposited in the center of the cluster of galaxies. But another important part is that even though the picture that I drew initially has active galactic nuclei having jets pointing right at you, and therefore their emission being very amplified, and of course if you do your standard relativistic transformations, jets like this would be extremely faint if the jet is pointing away from you or if it's pointing at a right line to the right angle to the line of sight. It turns out that the story gets more complicated because the amount of power that we see from the jet in this source, which we know that points relatively far away from our line of sight, is really quite substantial, and it's not consistent with the jet being really unidirectional. So there must be some other process, possibly having to do with acceleration of particles in a jet boundary, that might be associated with this object. So now I'm going to get into my